Hello, this is Warren Hoyt, and today I'm going to continue a review of Dr. Jay Richards' book, Money, Greed, and God, the subtitle of which is Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Today we're going to look at Chapter 2. The title of that is What Would Jesus Do? Remember, last time we were talking about how a lot of people today, especially the young, think very negatively about capitalism. And that's why I'm reviewing this book, because I think it's very important, the message that it has for us. Because even we as Christians have a hard time thinking of capitalism as something Jesus would approve of. Many times that's because we think capitalism is the same thing as greed. Or we think about the inequality we see in the world, the great gap between the rich and the poor and so on. And we wonder if capitalism isn't really just a system that makes the rich richer and the poor poorer, and so maybe Jesus would be against it. Well, what we've unwittingly done when we have those doubts and questions, according to Richards, is that we've bought into 8 myths or misunderstandings about capitalism which confuse our thinking. That's why I think this book is so helpful, because it sort of takes away the confusion. Last week in Chapter 1, we looked at what he calls the Nirvana myth. And that's the idea that people, a lot of times when they compare capitalism with things, and they criticize capitalism, what they often do is they compare it with some kind of an unrealizable ideal that doesn't even exist out there in the real world. And so compared with a fairy tale, well, capitalism might seem bad, but you got to realize we're not comparing with a fairy tale, we're comparing with the real world, and it's the best system that exists in the world. It's produced greater fruit, better fruit than any other system. So in the second chapter, what Richards does is he starts off talking about how God really does care about the poor. It's not a sideline issue. And so he lists many passages in the Bible that speak of God's concern for the poor. Passages in Deuteronomy, Proverbs, Amos, Luke. Jesus cared about the poor. But the point he makes here is that caring for the poor can't just be a good intention, something that makes us feel, you know, warm inside because we care. Or rather, it has to be something that we do with prudence, with wisdom, with common sense, and with an awareness of reality. Otherwise, we may feel good about what we're doing. We may think we're doing something good, but we're actually promoting or doing things that don't really help the poor. Actually harm the poor. And in the rest of the chapter, he discusses several current issues that are so prevalent in the news nowadays that have arguments people make for policies to supposedly help the poor. But Richard shows how all of them are unwise, wrongheaded, and harmful instead of helpful. These policies and these theories all fit into the second myth that he deals with in this chapter, a myth he calls the piety myth. What that amounts to is focusing on good intentions rather than the unintended consequences of our actions. So I'm just going to kind of quickly go over these modern day arguments. I can't deal with them in depth as he does. I hope you'll read the book, but I just want to give you the gist of what he's pointing out here. The first one he deals with is the so-called living wage argument. Nowadays, you constantly see people on TV saying that the government has got a mandate, a higher minimum wage to take care of the poor. Yeah, that sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, the rich fat cats are ripping off all these poor people. They should pay more. There should be a mandated higher minimum wage, right, to take care of all these people. Well, as Richards points out, the problem is that doesn't end up helping the poor. If the government is trying to control things from some bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., far removed from the realities of life, they're not going to be able to do it well. And here's a quote from Richards: to a business, employee wages are costs. The fact that Washington sets a minimum wage doesn't mean an employer can pay it. That's why countries with high minimum wages, like France, tend to have higher unemployment than countries with low minimum wages, like the United States. See, people mean well by this kind of talk. But what they're doing is shutting the door on entry-level people, young people getting jobs at McDonald's and stuff like that. Because if you jack the minimum wage up, you're going to make it where the employers can't hire anybody because they got to pay them too much. And they'll look for ways to do it with automation or whatever. They'll cut back. And it will make prices go higher. So it actually harms the economy and it harms the poor instead of helping them. Here's another quote I thought was real interesting. He says, union employees who rarely make minimum wage, and that's because, you know, they make more than minimum wage. Union employees, they like this idea of mandated minimum wage. Why? Because if employers have to pay that high minimum wage, guess what? They're not going to hire less skilled workers who have to be trained. And so therefore, the union's going to get power because of that. Did any of these people ever think of that? See, these are unintended consequences. Union employees love it. Hello. There's something really wrong with it. When the government meddles with free market, the minimum wage and subsidies for certain products or crops or whatever, they're meddling or interfering with the natural cause and effect processes that regulate the market. And Richards goes into that later in the book. It's really a great topic that he deals with. It makes a lot of sense on that. But the thing is here, it just doesn't work out for good, mandating minimum wage. Here's the second argument he deals with, the fair trade argument. And he talks about, you know, he's from Seattle, so he lives in Seattle. So he talks about how Starbucks, you know, they originated in Seattle and how they said that they're going to pay the coffee growers in Guatemala or whatever more than market price for their coffee. So they asked for more money for coffee. They're telling the people, hey, pay a little more to help the poor farmers in Guatemala. Well, it sounded like a great idea. So all these yuppies, you know, on their way to work, sure, I'll pay a little more for coffee. I want to help out those poor Guatemalan farmers. That makes them feel good inside, doesn't it? It makes them feel all warm and fuzzy. They're helping the poor. Well, but what Richards brings out is it actually backfires and doesn't help the poor at all. Liberals may feel good about it, but they don't realize it's not working because here's a quote. The problem is subtle. Paying artificially high prices for some coffee encourages poor farmers to enter or stay in the coffee market when it's against their long-term interest to do so. And then he talks about how what happened was coffee got so popular and people were making so much money on it that more and more countries that could plant and grow coffee and all started producing it. Well, what happens is when you get more and more people producing, of course, the price goes down. So if you try to jack that up and keep paying more and more, try to help these people, what you do is you're messing with the market forces. You can't hold back those forces interminably any more than you can control the weather. And so you're artificially propping up something that you shouldn't be artificially propping up. And what happens is that insulates the growers of the coffee beans from the realities of the market. And eventually there will be too much of the product and the high prices needed to keep those people going will crash. So they'll end up being out of work and the crash will be more drastic than it would have been if they just had been paid the market price for their product all along. See, trying to do something out of good intentions, but doing something that actually causes more harm than good. His next argument he deals with is the foreign aid argument. And he talks about Bono, you know, from the singer from U2 and these other celebrities, and they all want the government and others of the first world to increase their giving to help the poor countries of the world. So, you know, they have this campaign to get all these first world countries to give 1% of their GDP to the poor. Well, you know, Bono supposedly is a Christian. It sounds so Christian. It's so admirable. But Richards points out here, and it's just really, it's really sad to see the reality of this. But the truth is over $2.3 trillion have been given in recent years to help the poor, a lot of them in Africa and Asia and so forth. Unfortunately, it's basically accomplished nothing. Nothing. The countries that are poor, that started off poor, they're still poor. You know the deal. What happens is corrupt governments steal this aid. They sidetrack it. They misdirect it. They put it in their own pockets. It motivates corruption and laziness instead of initiative. You know, people get, they, some people make money off of it. Some people, they get the aid. They're not going to do anything. Dictators are actually supported by foreign aid. I like this quote from Richards. He says, Bert once told Ernie on Sesame Street, Bert once told Ernie on Sesame Street, it's easy to have ideas, but it's not so easy to make them work. And that is foreign aid. A nice idea doesn't work. Here's a quote from a guy named William Easterly. He said, the end of poverty will come as a result of homegrown political and economic reforms, which are already happening in many poor countries, not through outside aid. The biggest hope for the world's poor nations is not Bono. It's the citizens of the poor nations themselves. This sounds hard-hearted to some people. You know, all these rock stars, they have these concerts and all. You know, don't you want to help these poor people in Africa? What Richard is saying here is, guys, this doesn't work. It hasn't worked in years and years of time. Look at Haiti. I think that's a great example. Billions of dollars have been given to Haiti, a tiny little island, and it's still just as poor and wretched as it ever has been. If it was working, I'd be all for it. Richards would be for it, but it isn't working. The next argument he deals with is government-run welfare. Similar idea. Lyndon Johnson announced that, you know, he was going to conduct a war on poverty back in 64. And boy, you just got to read this section in Richard's book, because he has statistics and a lot of measurable things that you can see there that show that this war on poverty that Lyndon Johnson launched, and it's been continuing ever since, it has had the most terrible consequences that nobody ever imagined would happen. It sounded good, and it got black people voting Democrat like never before, but many years of trying it have proven that it not only doesn't work, it produces worse consequences than the poverty it's trying to relieve. I don't have time to go through it all, but man, he's got all these statistics, you know. The poverty rate was already declining when Johnson took office, and it had gone from 22 to 15% in the years 1959 to 65. But just after Johnson's war on poverty started, it settled in at around 14%. And guess what? It's stayed at 14% ever since, in spite of trillions of dollars being spent. But the unintended consequences of the welfare state, that's the worst thing. And they're very obvious. Family breakdown, illegitimacy, especially among poor urban minorities and white Appalachians. Cycles of dependency that transfer from generation to generation. Anger, despair, hopelessness. Activists say that this proves our society is racist. That's what the Democrats were talking about in this last election, constantly talking about racism, white privilege, and the injustice of it all, you know? But the truth is, these problems were exacerbated by the welfare state. They haven't been helped by the kind of policies that liberals favor. Not at all. In fact, it's very interesting. If you think about it, and I've argued this with people before, but during the 20s and 30s, racism was truly rampant. People were lynched. Blacks couldn't vote. They were, you know, terrible things happened. And yet, statistically, there was very little difference between the races in terms of illegitimacy. Why is that? If racism is the cause, then how come they didn't have illegitimate births and all that? They didn't have all these problems, social problems. Back then, when racism really was strong, as they do now when it's been mostly systemically eliminated. See, that's why I recommend another book I read by a Wall Street Journal writer named Jason Riley. You'll see him on Fox News a lot. He wrote a book called Please Stop Helping Us. He's a black man, and he says, look, don't continue these policies. They're killing my people. Years ago, we had a prayer meeting in our church, and I remember this one black pastor came, the Lord had been touching my heart about the black community. And I remember praying and saying, Lord, I don't know why the black community has suffered so much, why they're so poor, why 75% of them are born out of wedlock. Oh, God, help the black community. And after the prayer meeting was over, this black pastor came up to me and he said, "Pastor, I'll tell you why the black community is hurting so bad. I can tell you why it's hurting and when it started." And I said, "Really? What do you say? What's your answer?" He said, "It started in 1964 when Lyndon Johnson started the welfare state and the war on poverty. He ruined my people. Liberals, white liberals, tried to help the poor, and they basically destroyed us by all these policies." And again, Richards has all these statistics that show that for every dollar that they give, man, it reduces labor and earnings by 80%. A 10% wealth increase in welfare benefits resulted in a 12% increase in out-of-wedlock births. I mean, it just goes on and on. And it's been so many years now. You know, it's since 64. And so it's really something that's measurable now and studyable. And you can just see that the policies don't work. But the piety myth says, "Oh man, we got to try, you know, at least we have good intentions. We want to help the poor." And Democrats say, "You know, our party is the party of the poor. The Republicans, they're the party of the rich. They don't want to help anybody." Well, you know, I'm not trying to get political here, but the point is that it's not a party. The point is that it's policies that count. And you can say you have good intentions and that wins votes because you say that you believe that this community or that is underprivileged and they're suffering and we need to help them and we need to increase the minimum wage and we need to give more WIC and more welfare and subsidies and do all this stuff. But listen, hard facts prove it doesn't help at all. These are false arguments. They're based on this myth of piety. This government aid and everything, government bureaucracies can't eliminate poverty and help the poor. They're totally inefficient at it. They end up just promoting wrong behavior. Private charities are much better at it, and that's been proven. But here's a powerful quote from Richard's book. "The only known cure," he says, "for widespread generational poverty is capitalism." That's it. There's only one known path up the mountain. Why do we think Africa or South Central Los Angeles will get rich on foreign aid or charity when no society anywhere has gotten rich this way? Why should we waste 1 minute using those tools to fight poverty instead of working to spread the one thing that we know works? Isn't that a great quote? The campaigns to end poverty as we know it warm our hearts. They make us feel good, but they don't work. And Richard says the things that can actually help the poor, listen to this, sound about as glamorous as unsweetened oatmeal. Property rights, rule of law, personal virtues like diligence and thrift, ingenuity, cultural values like trust, an orientation to the future and a willingness to delay gratification. Yawn. Unlike all the crusades and petitions, however, these things create wealth. We know this. We Christians need to decide if we want to keep advocating what's hip and fashionable or the oatmeal variety stuff that actually works. Oh man, that is so good. I hope you get the book. It's Dr. J. Richards, Money, Greed, and God. Next week, we'll look at the next chapter and the next myth, which Richards calls the zero-sum game myth, believing that trade and capitalism requires a winner and a loser. I hope you'll join me for that one. For now, God bless you.